Great cut from Jeff Kashewa. That's called Here and Now. You're listening to Afternoon Jazz. It's 327. I'm Jim Steele. This is 90.5 FM, WSNC Winston-Salem. Jazz in all its colors from the campus of Winston-Salem State University. I'm Jim Steele. It's Wednesday afternoon, which means we have the opportunity to invite someone into the studio and have a conversation about what they are doing and how it affects your life and how it makes our community a richer place to be. And a lot of times we have artists on here. Which we love. We love our artists and our musicians and our nonprofits as well. But this time we've got a writer, editor, slash lots of different things. Andrew Snorton is in the studio with us this afternoon. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, thank you for having me on here, Jim, and to all the viewers and listeners. I hope everyone's having a great day, great week, and continued well wishes with all the things you're working on.
Well, let's talk about your company that you established yourself, went out on a limb, and came up with something that apparently has brought a lot of joy to your life, in addition to helping you help others in the community. So let's talk about your program to begin with.
Sure. On the business end, it's called Creative Community Solutions, and there's three different branches. There's the education-based services, where that ranges from doing your traditional tutoring, now during the now normal virtual tutoring for students who are preparing to go to college, ACT and SAT, whether it's the individual prep, previously working with different schools, different community organizations to get them ready. So those were some of the services on the education end. On the press and media end, very fortunate to actually have my own show based in the Atlanta, Georgia area on the Status Network called The Conversation Corner. That airs every second and fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that's a blend of entertainment, business, community, and more. So it's a blessing to be able to talk with people, as you mentioned at the outset, from the nonprofit end to folks who are working with top-notch, you know, and legendary entertainers and everywhere in between. And also on the press and media end, I've been able to work with different community-based organizations, different businesses with their press and media strategies. So hopefully get them on great shows like this show and great networks like this one. But just to help, you know, amplify and share the work that they're doing. And then finally on the writing end, I actually have edited a few fellow authors' works, such as Willie Cartwright, and working on a few other projects. And then under my own writing, since 2017, I've been very blessed to have written three books, one of which is in ebook form that we'll talk about today, and then three audiobooks. So it's like anybody, it's your share of moving parts, but it's a blessing. And just trying to help, you know, just plant seeds and let people grow and flourish as best as possible.
Let's get your background, Andrew, because you're in Atlanta now, but you were here at Wake Forest University, graduated from Wake Forest, and of course, you know the community well, and you come back here because you work with some very important organizations, literacy project that you're working on. But give us your background and how you got from Wake Forest back to Atlanta, or maybe it wasn't back to Atlanta, because I don't know where your home is.
Yeah, home is technically, that's a good question, because a lot of people are like, man, where are you today? But technically, Atlanta, Georgia is where I reside. I'm originally from the state of New Jersey, so for anyone out there that's familiar with Asbury Park, Neptune, Long Branch, Ocean Township, basically about 40 miles south of New York, a little bit over an hour away from Philadelphia. That's the area where I grew up. And as you mentioned, I attended Wake Forest University for my undergrad studies, and there are some things I'm still doing with the university. I'm thankful to be on the board for the School of Divinity, done some different work with the Association of Wake Forest University Black Alumni, Alumni Council, Greek Alumni Advisory Board, and a few other things. So it's great to be a part of that community, but I also know that there are other communities that make up the great mosaic of Winston-Salem. And through the nonprofit, I'm affiliated with the LEAD Foundation. Not only have we done college tours up in this area, including Winston-Salem State, but we have a program called the Literacy Project, where we help provide support to the Malloy Jordan Library, located in East Winston. And the tie there, just the history, named after the first black doctors in Winston-Salem, Forsyth County. It's not that far from one of the schools that was where, just put it blunt, black folk had to go, just to be honest.
Yeah, you had no choice.
Yeah, you had no choice. And knowing how important it is to that community, what we've been able to do periodically is either whenever I've had to come up here, I've driven up, or we shipped books, CDs, DVDs, other material to help support their stacks, because we know in that interlocking community, that might be for some people their only point of access. And while, you know, there's awesome resources there throughout the city, we don't want to neglect these areas that are in the neighborhoods, especially where for some people, again, that might be their only access due to travel or finances or things along those lines. So I think it's very important. If I can take time, you know, based on, you know, coming up here for school, and like my grandmommy said, I can see about other folks, and that's what I'm, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. So obviously, you're staying really busy. You've got a lot of different projects going on, but I personally know that from having gone to a non-HBCU, that one of your projects is finding your authentic Negro experience. And people who didn't go to an HBCU know what we're talking about. Because when you go to a majority white school, it's always like, what did I miss? There's something out there that, and you feel like you're searching. And you're in the community, and you're doing things that are important to the community. You talked about literacy. You talked about other things. But let's talk about that. Put things in perspective,
sure.
Because those of us, you're a lot younger than I am, but those of us who were the integrators, mm-hmm. our experience was quite different from those who were outside marching.
I'm gonna say this, like, there, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and the giants aren't always those from 1619. Or the late 1700s or the 1800s. Some of those giants are from the early 1960s, you know, like a Dr. Ed Reynolds, those folks that came after. And nobody knows fully the battles that were being fought. We might not recall all the names, but there's somebody who thought enough of you.
Yeah.
And that's what I remind myself. There's someone that thought enough of you to give you an opportunity. And regardless of your experience, and I'm just going to put it point blank to any black African-American that went to a PWI.
PWI?
Yeah, predominantly white institution. Yeah. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Regardless of your experience, you know that the younger version of you is going to be following you. So you've got one of two choices. You can either look at the things that didn't work out and just be, oh, let somebody figure it out, which means you are neglecting your charge to give back to somebody, because someone who did not know your name thought enough of you to see what battles they could fight so you could push the envelope. And I'll just say this, if we don't do those types of things, not only for our younger versions of us, anywhere, HBCU, PWI, if we don't take time to do so, then we're only going to be able to go so far.
And you've learned a great lesson, because one of the things that we don't really catch the first time around is the struggle continues. You must be ever vigilant.
Oh, goodness. Oh, that reminds me. What you just said reminds me of a time, the beginning of last decade, and shouts to the Wake Forest University Black Student Alliance. They invited me to be their keynote speaker for one of the events they would do every February, the Celebration of the Black Experience. And I remember saying the struggle is real, and it was just like the congregation just started saying something. I'm like, oh, wow. I was like, do you want me to finish and say the rest of it?
Yeah.
And I'll say this to throw a little bit out there, and y'all can, you know, pick it apart is the way you want. There is nothing new under the sun.
Nothing new.
Now, the way that package is delivered might be a little bit different, but there is nothing new under the sun. So, again, it comes back to my previous point. We owe it to those known and unknown that fought battles known and unknown for us to be here. And our charge, as best as possible, as consistently as possible, that we do something to continue to push the envelope, and it's okay as we get older, or even now, if there's someone that's a little bit more resourceful, there's no shame in passing the torch.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise you only reach a certain number of people, and we know we've come a long way, but there's still a little distance to run.
Andrew Snorton in the studio this afternoon. Andrew, we did not know each other except through Facebook or from alumni events, and you were always there. That's the thing I always knew about you, Andrew. You were always present. You were always there and engaged. Never had nothing negative to say about nothing. You had you had the business at hand, and you had a project that was always going on, and I admire the literacy project that you've got going on here in Winston-Salem. From the big city of Atlanta, you come back and you keep your hand in things that are going on here, but also in various communities around the country.
Yeah, I'm real fortunate, and I'll admit it's been a minute, so I know that there's folks up in Chicago at Holy Angels Catholic School, which was one of the schools that we've supported, that I know we need to get back to and things along those lines. So it's not to say that there haven't been hiccups along the way, but by the same token, you know, the proverbial saying, you know, we fall down and we get back up.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're focused on doing. I don't know. I guess really I get it from my parents, to be honest with you. My mom and dad, oh my goodness, they're still, I talked with them a little bit earlier. And outside of what they did career-wise, one of the programs that my mom did, formerly taught in Asbury Park Middle School up in New Jersey, was a program called Project EAT. And that acronym was Everybody Ate Today. So you know how there's the trend of the urban garden? They were doing that while my mom was teaching. My dad was so invested, like, in the lives of not only me and my older sister, from coaching to things with church and things along those lines, but beyond. And, you know, when you have great models and great examples like that, it gives you a good template to try to follow as best as possible. And like I said, it's just a blessing. It really is.
Andrew Snorton, were both of your parents in education?
My dad is retired from working in the insurance industry, and my mom is a retired educator.
And the reason I ask is people who have parents who are in education or related fields, they know that you have that they're raising a whole bunch of kids. They've got a whole lot of families out there because the needs are so great that when they come home, they're still thinking about those kids and they're still working for them. They ain't getting paid for it, but they still have there's a big burden on the back of educators out there, especially Black teachers and Black insurance agents and Black preachers. And, you know, you know what I'm talking about?
Anybody that is a public servant. I mean, it's not saying that people in corporate don't give time to give back.
Right.
But I think the nature of public servant, you know, your charge is to serve, but even bigger, your charge is to be a steward. And when, you know, you would see, like growing up, like I said, the investment, my mom, my dad, you know, other extended family members, things along those lines, it gives you something to emulate. You might not ever do it to their level. You might not do it exactly the way they do it, but in principle, you have an idea of what you're supposed to do. And that kind of parallels to different titles I've been blessed to have and things along those lines. You know, titles are cool, but the work behind it's more important.
Yeah, and I was thinking about your dad because I don't know him, but I do know what his profession is. But I was thinking about growing up and seeing my grandmother and my aunts, my uncles, the insurance agent would come by the house once a month and get and they would take the small payment so that people would have a way to bury themselves. And there was a time not too long ago when it was very, very difficult for Black people to get insurance. So to have insurance agents that would work with them so that they didn't have that burden on their families when they died, that was huge. So the insurance agency was part of the family as well.
It is. And I think about like the number of people, like my dad was able to really do what he can. He was able to work for one of the larger property and casualty insurers, but even still his principles were know your job, be dedicated to it, and be dedicated to the people. People are trusting you, you know, to help them make, you know, smart decisions. And that principle comes in any field. When I was in the classroom, your job is to try as best as possible to put people in a position where they can be successful. And even with the education services I'm doing now, I know tomorrow evening I've got to work virtually with some kids, actually tomorrow afternoon too. It's about just put people in the position, even if they don't get it when they're with you, you're laying the foundation to where they hopefully will get it, you know, somewhere down the line, but not too, too far down the line, but at some point down the line.
So let's talk again about your company. Remind us of your company, what you do, and how many different organizations you're involved with.
Oh, wow. Well, the last part's going to be difficult. The first part's easy. Business-wise, it's Creative Community Solutions. And again, we provide education-based services ranging from traditional tutoring, virtual tutoring, ACT and SAT test prep for individuals, community organizations, and schools. On the press and media end, the host of my own television show on the Status Network called The Conversation Corner, which airs every second and fourth Wednesday, 7 p.m., statusnetwork.net, where I bring in different guests across the board, entertainment, business, community, and more, work with different businesses and events regarding their, you know, being able to connect with radio, television, other media outlets. And then on the writing end, I have edited and we're still editing a couple of fellow authors' books, and I've written three of my own, one audio book and three, not one audio book, my apologies, one ebook and then three audio books.
Anybody who is in the profession, whether it's writing or whether you are a reporter or whatever, you know that to have a good editor is really a gift. Because you can learn so much from an editor. But the thing about editors is, you got some editors out there who they'll just sort of gloss over it because they don't want to hurt your feelings. And then you got other editors that bring a meat cleaver to it, and you're crying by the time they're done with it. But you have a better piece. It's all that to say, how do you work as an editor and keep the piece?
I think the first thing is just trying to set the tone and say, hey, look, my job is to make sure you still keep your voice, but it's to help amplify it, or what can we do to fine tune it so it comes out a little bit more fluidly. And everybody's at a different point, you know, in their writing, any author or what have you. I think sometimes if you go too far in regards to the meat cleaver approach, yes, you've done a good thing technically, but then you might dilute the person's voice. And then when they look at their work, it's like, wait a minute, this doesn't sound like me. This isn't me. Am I really speaking to my audience? Because then it's like teetering that fine line between we need to clean it up to we're focusing on a formula that works. On the other end, if you're too lax and whatnot, then it's like, you know, I can't translate this stuff. So yeah. For me, my thing is each and every person I've been able to edit with or what have you is trying to see what their voice is and what can be done to fine tune it. It's almost like getting like, you know, on the way in, getting that sweet tea. Do you want it? Sometimes you need a little bit syrupy, you know, you need the sugar rush, and sometimes yeah. You just need that pinch, and everybody is different. And so to me, you know, thematically, you know what you're trying to do, but then within those themes, you know, you're showing enough of that balance between the technical, but still letting people say what they need to say to speak with their audience as best as possible. And so far, I'm still above ground and upright, so I must be doing something right.
Andrew Snorton, you've brought one of your books with you. So tell us about what went into this publication.
Sure.
Because books are really big in this community, because we've had the Bookmarks event for 10 years. We have a very strong literacy community. You've talked about your role in the community as well.
Yes, sir. So the book that I brought today is my current release, which is called Nothing Minor. And Nothing Minor is basically chronicling my 2019 coverage of minor league baseball. So that included covering teams and games in Greensboro, North Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, Metro Atlanta, because the Atlanta Braves top minor league team is in Gwinnett County, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Birmingham, Alabama, and it's technically Pearl, Mississippi, but Pearl sits basically right next door to Jackson. And part of just looking at the minor league game, I was asked this the other day, why don't you go to the major leagues? Why don't you choose minor leagues? For me, in no particular order, that's a hidden jewel when it comes to sports.
I think you're right. I agree with you 100% there.
One of the big things is your price points.
Yeah.
And some of the – just so you think about, you know, when things fully reopen – and if you're trying to take your family out, you might not be able to get a ticket for Yankee Stadium. I know how much those cost just for sitting in right field a couple of rows off from the grass. And it's like, people can't, you can barely afford that just on your own.
Yeah.
And that's not knocking the Yankees. That's one of my favorite teams.
It
is what it is. But I think your price points make it a lot more, you know, fan accessible. The players are a lot more accessible. Some of the different specials, I remember Chattanooga, I got an invite to come back, and it was the anniversary of Coca-Cola. And they were selling, like, nickel Cokes, like the regular things for like 5 cents. And for the 21 and older audience, they have some very reasonable 21 and older specials, depending where you go, that might start at a dollar. I'm not going to say what they are, but we're just going to leave it to people's imagination. And this is where people have to understand minor league ball, for the overwhelming majority of people who pursue the sport, this is where they hone their skills, develop their talent.
Yeah.
But I wanted to take it a step further, so I was very intentional with the players I interviewed, because there's a narrative that sometimes, well, I won't say sometimes, oftentimes gets overlooked, and that's of black players. And when you think about the history of the game, that was one of the primary sports that, you know, when you think about Jackie Robinson, Larry Doby, even like, you know, Willie Mays and other players, that was that first real major entry point. So being able to interview players across the board, and even if you're not a fan of the game, there are some great insights that some of these players had, like Travis DeMeritt, who was with the Atlanta Braves system. He's now with the Detroit Tigers. One of the key things he said is, in regards to his growth and progress, sometimes you have to filter out the noise. And that noise can range from criticism of people who don't know their head from their tail, trying to tell you what to do, to sometimes you trying to talk yourself out of something which you really should be considering to pursue, to Tristan Casas, who plays with Greenville, which is the single A affiliate of the Boston Red Sox. So for people who are watching the World Series, Mookie Betts, who's the starting right fielder for the Los Angeles Dodgers, that's where he played minor league ball. And Tristan Casas, at the time I interviewed him last year, was like a year removed from high school, because we have to remember, for baseball, you can get drafted straight out of high school. And he said something very powerful to me after interviewing him in the team loss, and he's like, you either win or you learn a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting perspective in general, but from somebody 19 or 20 years old, that's pretty big. And so just not only getting that insight, the game action, photography, and shouts to Emery Rose Photography as they contributed. One of the things I'm really proudest of, I mean, the most, in addition to capturing those player narratives, was a narrative with the Negro Southern Leagues Museum in Birmingham, Alabama. They actually have one of the largest, if not the largest, archive of Negro Leagues memorabilia, from uniforms to baseballs, bats, and what have you. And especially what makes it significant is this year is the centennial, or the 100-year anniversary of when the Negro Leagues were established.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you think about that juxtaposition and cross-referencing, it's not by accident. So I'm really, really excited about that. So again, if you're a fan of the game, this definitely fits. If you're a fan of sports, this definitely fits. And even if you're not a fan of the game or a fan of sports, just to capture a narrative that gets overlooked, just enough history, just enough photography, you never know. You might be helping plant seeds for the next great writer or photographer or journalist or what have you.
Let's stay with baseball for just one moment more. And that is, the complexion of the game is changing. Because there was a time when there were so many huge names, African Americans, in baseball, and now it's kind of dwindling. It's like they're not that many in the sport anymore. There's still a lot, but they're not. It's going down.
It's definitely. I think about growing up once upon a time, like in the 70s, and it's like you would see. Once Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby and other players broke that barrier, like I said, that was where the first real floodgate was. And I remember in the 70s, I remember in the 80s, you would see a significant number. Then it seemed like it dropped off. And even though Major League Baseball had the RBI program and things along those lines, sometimes when you think about these younger levels, especially like American Legion and things along those lines, it's an investment. And there are some price points that can be significant. And on top of that, when the pivoting, especially for Major League Baseball, came to going to, you know, our colleagues of Spanish-speaking background, the Dominican Republic, things along those lines, you think about the influx of, you know, players from Cuba, it's almost like the black player was kind of lost. But I think now what's great, I think Major League Baseball, and even to varying degrees, minor league baseball, has a great opportunity to better showcase these top-notch players. Like Mookie Betts, who I mentioned before, came up through the Boston Red Sox system, played his minor league ball at one of the places I covered in Greenville, South Carolina. When Betts was with Boston, not only did he win a World Series, but he was named Most Valuable Player. And now with his trade to the second largest media market, Los Angeles, some people might not realize the Dodgers signed him to a record extension. Mm. He's actually the second highest paid player in the game. And if people watched the game last night, he hit a home run and stole two bases. Like, this guy is really, really good. So when you look at a player like a Mookie Betts, you look at a player like a Tim Anderson, the shortstop for the Chicago White Sox, who played his minor league ball at one of the places I covered, Birmingham, Alabama. Tim Anderson won a batting title, which meant he was the top hitter in the American League last season and is one of the top players. So there are opportunities for, you know, major leagues, minor leagues with some of these prospects. One of the people I was able to help amplify was Travis Trammell when he was with Chattanooga, which is part of the Cincinnati Reds system. He was their top-rated prospect and one of the top 20 prospects still in minor league baseball. So even though he got subsequently traded to the San Diego Padres system last year and then this year got traded to Seattle, this kid is like a year or two away from being in the big league. So there are opportunities to amplify and share these stories. I mean, they're
Africa World Now.
Sorry. That's all right. That happens. There are opportunities to amplify these stories. So I think whether it's the media or even better, I'll just say this, who better to tell our stories than us? So when last year, when I think about covering these minor league teams, I mean, I was doing pregame when other people weren't. I'm doing postgame when other people weren't. And when you look at the makeup, I'll say this, and this is from talking with one of my colleagues, David Grubb from Hard in the Paint Sports. When you look at the makeup of your sports journalists, and depending on the resource, maybe 10, 15% look like you or me. So that means there's a lot of things that are overlooked. So I would put this challenge out to anybody out there who's thinking about media, thinking about writing, who thinks, well, there's not that many. Why should I go? But then again, when Jackie Robinson played, there was nobody that looked like him. And sometimes in real life, there might be nobody that looks like you. So who's to say that you might not, you know, who's to say where or where you might, you know, be led or called or what have you? So again, I think there's a great opportunity, especially with how media is now and how, you know, just some of these top players, that they have a golden opportunity to amplify. Or if they want to hit me up, hey, I'm just saying, closed mouths don't get fed. They can hit me up and we'll see what we can do to make it happen.
We'll share the information on our website. Andrew Snorton, thanks for dropping by for the conversation.
Hey, I appreciate it. And again, to all the viewers and listeners out there, seriously, continued well wishes and blessings with all you're working on.